for anyone who's listening right now, come down to Roberta's, 261 Moore Street, in Bushwick. Throw down a couple bones, get a couple beers. It's all for a good cause, rooftop garden. Your microgreens that you enjoy in your pizza might just be growing on that garden.
It's true.
This do you want to rob yourself of that?
Let me just kind of clarify maybe a little bit of what it is that we're doing in this first project that we are raising money for right now. We're trying to get a rooftop farm on a charter school in Bushwick, so we can kind of solidify an idea of how to make rooftop farms that we can put everywhere.
Is this sort of like the Alice Waters program she did out in Berkeley?
It's a lot like that program.
And then I guess
we're just kind of doing it like pirates.
Well, yeah. I mean, she's not a pirate.
She's kind of a pirate.
She's a pioneer.
I take it back. I was going to say she's a pioneer.
She's a pirateer. No, that
she kind of is.
I'll take that word.
Yeah.
Let's see it in the Slanguage Dictionary in a few years. A pirateer?
This language? Pirateer.
Huh. Okay.
I don't even know what that means.
And then I guess, well, that's great. Do you have the school picked out?
There's a charter school on Flushing we're trying to get the roof for. The idea is to add some curriculum to the school system, and then they would pretty much benefit off the fresh produce that's growing on the rooftop. Now, we're doing this so we can kind of make a model of a farm that works on any roof. So we really have some work to do. We probably have to do 3 or 4 of these before we can actually figure out how to make it viable, which is ultimately what we're trying to get to, a viable rooftop farm.
I mean, you got to reach out to Jamie Oliver. Do you see the article in the New York Magazine?
The recent magazine.
About him like changing the way that people eat. And he went, where'd he go? South Carolina.
It was actually just in the New York Times.
Just in the New York Times about how he's going around and trying to do the same thing in schools.
I think it's great. You really have to change the way that kids think about food and see food.
Well, and you got to change the way parents think about food,
That's
too.
That's true.
Because
kids walk into a supermarket and they don't really understand where this stuff comes from.
No, so, if I grew up and my parents were just buying me Doritos. And
I mean, you can make anything taste like Cool Ranch, which is kind of awesome, though. You have to respect that, right? Can you make beer taste like Cool Ranch, Shane?
Yes. Oh, definitely.
I just put ranch in my beer, and I did.
Not everyone feels the same way that you were talking about. We got folks in the room who grew up on a farm.
Of course.
So they know what it's like. And I was actually at Ephraim's farm. Ephraim's standing behind me right now. And when you wake up and you realize, like, first thing you do is you go out and you take care of the animals and you walk around in the fields. And I was up there early one morning. And, like, the connection that you have to your food is a lot more direct and intimate. And that's, like, kind of where this is going with the green roof, because even if it's just day-to-day maintenance, like taking weeds out, watering, and just observing the food, like that alone already gives you a deeper connection with your food.
Yeah, of course.
You know what I mean?
I have to ask, as a city kid growing up, and you know, I don't know, growing up on a farm. Did you grow up on a farm? Is that what you're saying?
No, homeboy behind me did.
All right, so question to homeboy.
Ephraim,
nice to meet you. What was it like to raise a pig or a cow from a young animal to maturity and then slaughter? I mean, what's that connection like? Not just like, you know, because people now have, you know, they have pig shares and they have things like that, but literally growing up on a farm, spending years with an animal and then bring it to slaughter and eating it. What is that experience like? Because that is, I will say, unique. I mean, it's a handful of people that get to experience that. And what's that like?
It was very unique. I have a story. When I was like in about second grade, third grade, we had our chicken harvest one summer morning where my parents organized a bunch of people to, you know, slaughter the chickens and process them and get them ready to be frozen so that you can eat them later on. And during the process of plucking the feathers and taking the guts out and stuff, I slammed the knife on the table and I said, "This is barbaric."
Of course.
And
he's currently vegetarian.
Yeah.
Are you really vegetarian? Yeah.
Oh. He is.
Was it because of those experiences?
Partly. Definitely contributed to it. But there are a lot of factors in my decision to change my diet about 10 years ago.
But you killed the vegetables too.
Yeah. I used to go deer hunting and all that, but
I'm still a big advocate of killing things. Sorry. There's just something about it. I mean, as long as you're using that.
He says it with a maniacal laugh.
But I guess as the type of person who grew up on a farm and seeing piglet to slaughter, you have, I guess, more the right of anyone to have that decision. More than most people who are just like, oh, it's a cultural thing, I'm a vegetarian.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel, I mean, what do you feel about like the fly-by-night vegetarians who do it because it's cool?
Well, I try not to make those type of judgments against people. I'm more of the mindset, you know, that vegetarianism isn't right for everyone, but everyone has the right to choose and decide what diet is best for them. And
two choices are steak or chicken.
Yeah. Then what?
Right.
Oh, and your green is a baked potato, by the way.
Womp womp.
Crow works too.
Crows work too. Oh, the claps.
Oh, the clap. There you go.
The hand clap. You guys know the sampler much better than
I
do.
No, we don't, because when we're doing our show, it's like we're just like,
just press a
just
button.
Just press button. Sometimes
matter.
It works.
You know.
Where did you grow up? What farm was it? Where were you?
I grew up in south central Wisconsin near Madison.
Mm-hmm.
A 240-acre farm, but most of it is woods. So there was like 80 acres of land for arable land for growing mainly feedstock for our animals, you know, the cows and
And you had dairy cows, or you had beef?
Beef cattle.
Great.
That is the biggest reason for me to become a vegetarian is the amount of land that's used for growing feedstock contributes to erosion, and it's an induced monoculture, which is...
Of course, but there's also other ways to approach farming, you know. I mean, if you have a different perspective on how you're going to do it, you can change. Besides saying, I'm not going to eat beef, you can also say, I'm going to change the industry and how we raise beef, you know.
True, but there's a lot of people who want to go back to more free-range style animals, but in a variety of animals. And if you look at the amount of meat that we currently consume, and if we took all of our herds of livestock and made them all free range, so if all the chickens and all the cows that we currently have in this country went free range overnight, would there actually be enough land to accommodate them?
That's debatable though as well.
Right.
I mean, with modern mycology, there's ways to improve permaculture techniques to have more heads per acre, and
right.
And like we have to understand ourselves as an evolving creature. We're like right. a bacteria. We're like mold. We're constantly going to evolve.
Are you saying we need some soil and green?
No, but I think if you presented,
let me fill you up on some.
I think if you presented man with being like, you're going to run out of food unless you come
of
up
course.
With a viable solution,
of
and
course.
The solution you know, this is all what is, but if you're running out of food. And you need to have everything be like hormone free, you know, you can't sustain on corn anymore. If you presented these problems to man and like, oh, and you can make money off of it, they would change. And you know, it's
right,
a lot of that's a lot of what is, but you know, right now it's pretty much well known that like one of the biggest causes of like carbon emissions is big farming.
Diesel. Yeah.
It's big farming. I mean, like it's more than almost anything else, and that America in itself is one of the lead cause, but you know, changing the food supply is not an easy thing, you know, unless someone like David Camp, who wrote United States of Arugula, made an argument that the only way to really change the way that people eat is if you get a business like McDonald's or like
of course,
or anything like that, to be like, all right, fine, we're tired of this, we're gonna do it, but you know, but it's a bottom line type of thing. You need, you know, they buy their.
There's oil, nothing wrong with that. People are so
no. There's nothing. Averse. There's nothing wrong with that, but no. But you know, you need
it. It creates livelihoods, and the thing is that you have to have, like, if you look at McDonald's as like an entity or a larger family.
Yeah.
What you think, if someone can start something that has the potency of McDonald's, like as a business model, but do it in a way that sort of cradles what we're talking about, you need to, like, I mean, just think of all the genius gimmicky things that they did over the years, like the Happy Meal.
The Happy Meal was amazing. What was the one? They knocked it out of the park. It was cold on one side and hot on the other side. It was in the 80s.
And just like the whole, they had the cartoon and they had the Hamburglar and the whole
Hamburglar.
Deal. Right. So if someone can rock that, but make it fun, Schoolhouse Rock style, but with all the stuff that's going on now in a grassroots movement, then it'll have that effect.
But what's it going to take, and not being involved with farming or, you know, crafting beer or anything like that, like just being as normal as a citizen as you can be with a mind little bent toward food, like what is it really going to take? To everyone knows about it now. Like when people didn't know that smoking was bad for you, now we know smoking, people know that, like, mass farming and this type of thing, it's not good for you anymore. So what is it going to take to get to the point where policy has to shift and the world starts moving to a direction? Because right now people are like, oh, it's too tough, but what's the breaking point?
I think it's going to take cheaper prices. That's what drives everything. Like smoking, when they raised prices for cigarettes, people stopped. And, you know, it's just a matter, it's common sense. Like a normal person, if you don't educate yourself and you're just deciding between A and B.
Well, the market's decided by all the processed food. Right. So that's the unfortunate part. As the processed food market goes down, then the organic market can go down as well. So until that food system changes, which is, how do you change that system?
Well, Kathy's on to the biggest point, and she and I were talking about it this weekend. If you think about it from a biological perspective, how on earth can a hamburger cost less than a salad? Yeah, I mean, the very fact, like, you can go to McDonald's and get an organic salad now, but on their cheeseburger special, like, the very fact that you can get a cheeseburger for under $1 is ridiculous if you think about all the energy and the work and the materials and the transport and everything that went into making that. So it's subsidized. Like, what you see in the grocery store and what you pay for, it's an illusion. You're paying for it in different ways, but it doesn't show up on the price tag. And so that's the same thing with, like, a gallon of milk or a pound of beef or anything that's heavily subsidized. And I think, like what Kathy was saying, like, you can really influence behavior by influencing people with prices. Like, you know, like, you want to get people, you can encourage people to have children by giving them tax breaks for every kid they have. You can discourage them by doing the reverse. And you can, like, with smoking, when a pack of cigarettes was $1.50 a pack, it's no big deal. In New York now that's $9, $10, and then at, like, some, like, places, vending machines, $12, $15 a pack, people are not going to want to smoke as much when they're paying that much.
Of course, that's hit them in their pockets,
and that's like called policy changes. So then you have to get the people in D.C. to be enacting these things to influence behavior by means of incentives through taxes and subsides.
And do you feel like this is happening? I mean, we're seeing more and more.
It totally well, actually, is. I can tell you, an alternative really energy. It's happening in a big way. This is not as much related to food, but Ephraim deals with this because he works with energy conservation and stuff like that. And right now in New York State and in a lot of states, like, if you want to rock photovoltaic or solar hot water or anaerobic digesters and stuff, there's huge incentives out there. Huge incentives.
And I think it's really cool when I talked with Gabe, Chef Gabe here at Roberta's, about the new rooftop farm project. One of the things he wanted to stress was that he was trying to make this the new program's food to be very competitive in the marketplace, so people actually buy it, and it won't be more expensive. It'll still be sustainable, you know, because people have this huge illusion, rightly so. It's not an illusion of sustainable local food being more expensive.
Of course,
but it doesn't have to be. So the object. It sounded like, and you can. I'm sure you guys are into this. Like it just making it more practical, accessible, and also economical.
But here's my question: at what point is a truly organic, antibiotic, free-range chicken breast gonna cost less than a chicken breast sandwich from McDonald's?
You know what? It shouldn't cost as little as it should. I mean, this is what everybody's...
It should cost what it costs to make. But at what point are there going to be tax?
A perception of value. Nobody understands what anything's worth right now.
No, I know, but
screwed up for a long time as far as putting a value to something. They subsidize things, so you say, right, I can take the value down of this because I'm going to make it here. So if you're a corporation and you own many things, you can sell this for this and something else for really cheap, and you subsidize your costs through things.
Well, that's the problem with a corn-based system, is that corn is subsidized by the government, and what it costs to grow corn is never reflected in the price because they can't sell as much, and so that's what goes into our food. But, I mean, you know, when people use the example of cigarettes, it's sort of a false pretense because it wasn't like, oh, well, if you smoke organic cigarettes that are
there's no alternative
with free range tobacco. it's not going to be better. American spirits versus like Marlboro, like it doesn't make a difference. Yeah. But
I mean, they're still the same price.
Yeah, they're yeah. But
there's ways to lower the impact of the financial costs by being more involved with, you know, local farmers or CSAs, which, you know, everyone knows how popular that movement is becoming.
But yes, that's easy. Okay, it's easy to say in New York. Even in New York, that's a metropolitan, that's like, you know, there's no like local farm, you know, I mean, discounting what you can build, but I'm talking about farm.
If you put a garden on 20% of the roofs in New York, you would definitely have pretty close to enough produce for most of those, at least those communities.
I totally agree with you.
If you get the communities involved, you start changing the way people see.
But if I'm in, you know, wherever the problem, like wherever Jamie Oliver was in South Carolina, problem land, you know, no name, no nothing town that was an old coal mine, that the earth has been raped of all nutrients and things like that. Like, and people aren't, there aren't forward thinking minds of the incentive of to bring in, you know, solar panels, you know, greens, you know, things like that. Like, you know, that's really where the money in the base of these corporations are looking. You know, attacking a New York market is one thing, but attacking like the majority of like the Midwest, the Southwest, and things like that, like where does that shift come? Like
you go to war with the weapons that you have. So you have to figure out what it is you need in your community. And you have to tack it there. You can't say that, hey, I'm going to bring in solar panels. Like, that's far beyond, that's a reach beyond what most people can do. You can start by composting your own waste and like having your own compost pile. Then
is that a
growing
need for most people?
It's not a need, but if you want to change the way you eat and you want to do it cheaply, you can have a small garden anywhere. You can have a small garden.
No,
anyone
true.
Can
that's
have a small
true.
Garden. You have to be willing to make the decision that you're willing to put a little bit more time into what you eat, and that's just something that people need to deal with themselves. Whether or not I'm going to take that extra few hours to like throw my worms some compost and then use that later to feed my plant, like. That's up to the individual. So if really eating well is out there for you and that's what you're trying to do, you can do it yourself. You can grow enough in the window this size, which is what about 4x4, to probably feed like a two family, you know, home, relatively like supplement it into your diet.
I hear you 100%. However, I know Darren really likes really good food. But I know he's not going to make a garden because he doesn't have time.
Yes, but I guess this goes to the question, is the movement, is it one by one? Or do you try and attack the masses? I mean,
Of course. Yeah, I mean, you obviously you try to attack the masses. Mm-hmm. You try to make a big surge of this movement, mm-hmm. and you try to get everyone involved. And everyone doesn't need to have a garden. I mean, you know where to go to get good food.
I mean, you're willing to pay for it.
So it doesn't really affect you. The people that it affects is the people that don't have the money to go out and buy good food. And
that's why we need to engage them in this dialogue too.
Of course, and I think that's kind of what we're trying to do is get communities involved instead of saying, "Hey, this is an obsolete thing. This is a thing for people with money and mm-hmm. affluent people everywhere." Can get involved in this, and we can all eat wheat, and we can all grow vegetables. It's kind of that's not what we're trying to do. You want to put this into get a culture involved and get like a neighborhood involved, and then build a community and show people really like what it's like in Bushwick to have a farm. I mean, these people have never had that opportunity. You never know where these people are going to take this once they do have the opportunity. So
I'm just playing devil's advocate because I'm totally psyched.
But do any of you
going to be great?
Do any of you think that a sustainable and local American agricultural system, both veggie and veg and protein, is reality?
Going to be totally different.
It's
not going to
really
be what
hard.
Any
it's
of
gonna,
us can define right now.
Of course. I mean, we're this is a changing of the guard for everyone. We're traveling into the great beyond, and mm-hmm. we have to just be confident that what we're doing is the right thing to do, and we can make it happen. I mean, mm-hmm. this is why you have fundraisers like this. There's so much new money out there of people just throwing around money just to make the world better. And we just really need to find who those people are and stream that money into like growing communities and getting fresh food to places that aren't getting fresh food.
What do you think?
Speaking of food, I'm really hungry.
where I grew up, you can see the change in people's mindset happening over the last 10, 15, 20 years. The amount of organic foods being grown and the availability of them increasing and expanding, and the CSA movement is huge in Wisconsin, where I'm from, and so there's pockets of this type of thing happening. If it's happening in Wisconsin, I'm assuming it's happening all over the country. So
you're seeing it everywhere, really. We are seeing it everywhere. So we are seeing change happen. I mean, positive change is happening.
But is it change, and again, just sort of pushing, but is it change within the circles that we know about? Because these mean forward thinking and the types of people,
Wisconsin's state motto, by the way. Forward thinking.
But that's just like, everyone who's involved is going to have that type of thinking.
It's good enough. That's the one I was looking for.
But I mean,
you don't have a cow.
Everyone who's involved, everyone that you legitimately sit down, have a couple beers with, and talk about food policy, everyone here is sort of on the same page.
Of course, of course. I feel like I'm preaching at the choir whenever I talk about.
Just having a show alone on like Heritage Radio, when we bring on guests to talk about food policy,
we're really talking to people who already know about this.
That's the thing. And so my question,
that's what I'm saying. Like, we're trying to take this to a charter school in Bushwick, where you're talking about inner city kids getting involved. And this is really the major problem. The outreach needs to be beyond our demographics. We need to go beyond our demographics, and we need to start reaching out to everybody. So, we started selling bread at the Bushwick Farmers Market, and it was a little bit hard at first, to tell you the truth. They were really kind of mesmerized by this kind of bread. You know, the first few weeks, it was like we weren't selling any loaves of bread. We'd bring 40 loaves of bread, 40 loaves of bread would come back. The next week, we'd bring 40 loaves of bread, 30 loaves would come back. And now we sell out every time, but it took them a while to understand this weird, like, ball of bread is something that's delicious and they can take home. It costs $3, so it took a little bit of time to get these people involved, and I think that the most important part is that we keep going back out and we keep fighting the fight, and we keep saying, hey, this is what we offer. It's cheap. It's a cheap alternative. It's great. We make this here. We make this right down the street from you. Get involved in this community. So,
and then teach them how to make bread.
Of course. That's the next step. I mean, education ultimately
ultimately is the final step.
I mean, how do you really move forward unless there's some sort of curriculum teaching people how to set up, a window garden, you know?
And then at some point you got to say, I've taught you 10. So each of you, you go out and teach 10 people, and then I'm going to focus on my next 10 and things like that. So, and there it is.
I agree. And there it is.
There it is.
And there it is. Do we want to talk about anything else? We have Joe Bastianich just kind of staring at us right now. It's amazing.
Joe Bastianich should come in because...
I think Joe should come in right now. Before he gets in here,
I just want to say, you know, I working for the Food
Network... I feel really intense watching Joe just stare at us.
By the way, you know, he's an example of a guy who shifted the way he ate.
Of course.
When he did the marathon.
Of course.
And he took his own life into his own hands. And you know, people are like, oh, all these chefs and everything like that. Like, no, it's so tough. But, you know, here's a guy who...
And speaking of, we have now Joe Bastianich. Well, maybe you can ask him the question that we were just talking about.
Well, we were just talking about taking food policy into your own hand and shifting that. And, your story of, I think, when you ran the marathon of you shifting what you ate and taking personal responsibility is tough because you're surrounded by decadence of all times. But what was that transformation of you going from the chef decadence to the marathon, I guess?
Doctor's orders. No, but, you know...
But you still had to make the transformation and you had to...
For me, it was really about like integrating exercise into being a real part of my life on a daily basis, and then eating sensibly. I mean, I always ate sensibly. The problem is, I like to eat mm-hmm. a lot, you know. And,
yeah.
You gotta moderate that.
Do you think the quality of what you ate, because that's what we were just talking about, the price, and the problem of eating, non-quality food. Do you think you could sit down with a quality chicken breast versus a processed chicken breast and have the same meal? The organic one count for less and like fat and things like that. Do you think that would affect like what you ate and things like that?
I think that I've always tried to eat the right way, as far as eating the right kind of proteins and that are, begotten the right way. But in dieting, I think that you have to kind of be more sensible in your consumption and moderate among food groups, eat smaller meals more frequently in a lot of ways, just keep yourself closer to your food. I don't mean that in a geographic sense, but also just like how you integrate it into every part of your life.
But even geographically, keeping it closer helps. I mean, you see what's happening and you feel like you're a part of the cycle. And just, being involved in what you eat is going to change the way your perspective on how you're going to eat anyway. So... I think it really helps to get your hands in and get dirty, if you will. Be part of the food process.
Now, do you think it's a chef and restaurant culture's also responsibility to shift food policy, food costs, food culture?
Totally. I mean, it's a double-edged sword, right? Because it's definitely our responsibility. But I think that the inherent problem with the whole movement conceptually that it's very bourgeois. It's very elitist, and that's a big issue. Because if you look at 95% of the people, they can't eat that way because A, they can't afford it, and if they can't afford it, they don't have access to where it grows, and it doesn't work in their lifestyle. And if you can do it, if you can commit your life to it and you don't have a lot of other things, it's a great thing. Or if you have the finances and resources to have that kind of a lifestyle, it's also great. I think that our responsibility is to continue to move it down through the market. And whatever you do, whatever way you sell food or you propose food to the public, to make sure there's always greater accessibility to eating the right way.
What's I guess, and this is the thing we can come back to, is like, what is the breaking point? So, let's say it's truffle season in Italy and your customers want truffles and that's, $3,000, $6,000, that type of food where you go, you could easily say, well, sorry, we don't have truffles tonight, but we do have these locally foraged mushrooms that are not as good, but they're just as tasty. At what point are you like towing to the elite class where you could be giving money to the people who really, need a farm or something like that?
I think that most restaurants would welcome both. because right. quite frankly, there's not enough forage mushrooms in the world for those who are willing to pay top price for them.
Not at all.
No. And the it gets back to the point that the kind of food that you're talking about has a huge demand, therefore it has a very high price point, and it's available only to a very small part of the market.
So what type of system would it take to set up one like a truly successful on both critics, profit, customer, like a sustainable full circle 360? Like, what would it take? What type of setup would you need for that restaurant that isn't something that's, you know, a couple...
We're sitting in probably the closest to inception that I've ever seen of it. But I mean, you know, aside from Roberta's, it's a different, you know, it's difficult to do it, you know, because the one thing is if you're in the restaurant business, you have to make money, because if you don't make money, you don't exist. And all the great intentions in the world can be flushed down the toilet if the business...
I mean,
business
they don't really mean anything.
They don't mean anything if you can't
sustain it. It has to be viable. Right. It has to be economically viable. You have to make money.
I mean, if Roberta's didn't make money, would you continue?
We wouldn't exist.
I
wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be doing this. None of us would be sitting here talking right. about anything. I mean, it has to make money. And that's the whole thing with this farm. Is
but that's the design. What, you know, the profit is an extension of your intention, but not your primary intention. So, like, you can go into something without the intention
of
making money, but the profit is like a byproduct of what you do. You know what I mean? Whereas sometimes people can go into something with the sole intention of making money, and then they may generate a profit out of that, but then it's not what it manifested.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great perspective to have on it. I mean, the farming instance, we're going at it being like, this has to be economically viable. We can't possibly develop a modular farm that you can put on any roof in New York if it's not viable. There's no reason to do it. I mean, there's a few things, there's a few bonuses for doing it. I mean, it may help you keep your energy down. I mean, there's a lot of theories on why it's great. In the long run, it has to be economically viable or it doesn't really work. Nobody's going to do it. I'm not going to be able to sell anyone a rooftop farm unless there's a reason for it to be there.
Yeah. Now, what do you see as the future of like rooftop farming in New York? Do you see it as something that's a...
once you get around all the logistical aspects of it...
Logistics gone.
It makes all the sense in the world, right? I mean, there's a million reasons why it makes a lot of sense. But, you know, I think that, you know, the first elements of what you see in places like this are certainly interesting. They certainly make it... It works and it's real. And obviously it has a place in the world. There's a lot of empty roofs, you know, that could be... producing fruit. And
I mean, it's not even just roofs. You see empty space, and now I just have a different perspective just from these small little projects, but you see empty space and immediately I think, I mean, what could be here that could be changing the way we look at how we feed people in New York City? And I'm looking at this very much so just as this community and Bushwick specifically. It's most important that we start changing the way people eat right here. I mean, this is as inner city as it gets. East New York's right here. Really, the outreach to teaching kids in these neighborhoods that this is how food is grown. It's not processed. You know, you can't just add Cool Ranch to everything and it tastes good. There's actually things have to be done. You know, this is as simple as you're going to get food.
I like it. Ranch is so artificial, they have to name it after a farm. Like, it's ranch.
I've never actually thought about why they named it Cool Ranch.
I think it's Hidden Valley Ranch, right?
They is made it? Hidden Valley Ranch?
It was the first mass-produced ranch. And they actually never could simulate the taste of the ranch dressing, so they just made up something because most people have never been.
Then they went into Doritos, right? Isn't there a ranch-flavored
Yeah,
Dorito?
Cool Ranch. That's, and, cool. That's and where now, the cool came from.
Cooler Ranch.
Cooler.
In case the ranch
got cooler over the years. And is that like a teal bag?
Yeah.
Yes. It's teal. It's like that.
All right, guys. I'm going to go eat some more dinner.
Thank you,
Jay. Nice
thank
you so much.
Thanks for having you.